So this is week five of session five. We're focusing on time. I was just thinking this morning that, you know, we've been reading around a little bit. So in the reading for today, which is from Knowledge of Time and Space, we're in the knowledge section. And at other times in this session, we've been looking at things that are where the focus is really space. But we've been looking at them from a time perspective, and I think it's good to be just to point out that that's true. You know, the distinction between time and space, or among time and space and knowledge, is important and valuable. But it's also just looking at the same set of phenomena. You know, what's involved in being human. From different perspectives, and they're not hard and fast lines. So today we're looking at the knowledge section of knowledge in time and space, but we're doing it from a time perspective, and I may point out a couple of places along the way where that seems to me to be clear, where we could clearly do that, clearly see the significance of that. One second, I'm going to actually turn off one piece of software. Okay, now we're ready to go. Let me make one practical announcement. I was thinking that the reading that was an optional reading, so for people in the training program, it's required. But the optional reading for this week, which was an early chapter in Knowledge of Time and Space, pages 35 to 43. I'd like to have everybody read that for next week. So you could make a note of that, and I'll certainly put it in the orientation for next week also. So if that turns out to be too much reading, read that and think of the TSK reading as optional, but it's not a lot of reading. So I hope you get a chance to do it all. So that's the practical issue for today. What we're looking at in this reading is similar to what we were looking at. Whoops. Okay, I don't know who that was. What we're looking at in this week's reading is similar to what we looked at in last week's reading, namely, it's an analysis of our ordinary ways of knowing, and in particular the ways of knowing that operate when we put the self at the center. And you may have noticed that the way Knowledge of Time and Space is structured is there are these little units. So each chapter, these short chapters in the book, fall within certain unifying themes, and the unifying theme for the chapters that we're reading this week and next is self-center. And so the self at the center, that's really the analysis that most of this reading does. Now, next week, toward the end of the reading, it will start to suggest how we could go beyond the understanding, the knowing that puts the self at the center. And that's one reason why I want everybody to read that earlier chapter, even though it's very early in the book. It also addresses that same theme. So what we're doing is looking at our ordinary way of knowing, and of course that also means our ordinary way of being in time, and because the two, along with space, you know, they always operate together. If time and space are operating or are available to us in a certain way, then a certain kind of knowledge is available to us. And there are limits on that kind of knowledge because of the limits on our understanding of or experience of or connection with time and space. So we're looking at our ordinary way of knowing and of being in time. And I just want to acknowledge something, that a lot of people don't find this to be the favorite part of the TSK books. You know, there's a certain impatience, I think, that people sometimes have when you're reading about what's wrong with our ordinary form of understanding or our ordinary way of knowing. They think they already understand it, or they're willing to concede it, because usually what brings people to the study of TSK is a sense that there are limits that we would like to be able to break through or transcend or dissolve in our ordinary understanding. And so they say, yeah, I know that. Now tell me what to do. Tell me how to go beyond those limits. But Rinpoche again and again takes the time to patiently lay out the limitations on the way we know. I just read something. I learned a new abbreviation today, an internet abbreviation that people apparently use, which is TLDR, and it stands for too long, didn't read. You send it to somebody. You send it to somebody because you think it's interesting, but you didn't read it yourself. So the article I was reading, it was in the Times, if anybody wants to look, the New York Times, says more and more people do that. People just read headlines. But anyway, it's kind of like that. You get to a section like that in the TSK books, and you say, yes, I know it's all... we're doing it all wrong. Our understanding is all wrong. Now tell me what to do about it. Don't rub it in. Don't make me think about it a lot. And I just want to say that that's missing the point. Maybe that's kind of obvious, or at least it's missing an important point. It's as though you set out to do something. Maybe you're going to build a rocket, and then you build the rocket and you launch it, and it explodes. Well, you want to understand why it exploded. You don't just want to say, oh, too bad, we'll have to start over again. But you don't know what you did wrong. Well, our usual way of knowing is like an ongoing way of doing something, not exactly wrong, but doing something in a limited way. And if we're going to break through that, we need to be able to understand how the limitation arises, how it operates. And another example I was thinking of is something they do in engineering schools. They actually do it now in grade schools for young children, but it's more interesting when you do it in engineering school. An assignment that people get is you're given an egg, a raw egg, and you're supposed to take it to the top of a building and drop it, and figure out a way to so that when you drop it, the egg doesn't break. And so you're given a certain, some materials to work with. And you're supposed to construct something that will let the egg be protected so that it doesn't break when it hits the ground. I think it's kind of a nice, analogy for what we'd like to do, especially if you think about, ways that kind of break out of the mold. So, for instance, sometimes people, instead of trying to come up with some really cool kind of packaging that keeps the egg from breaking, will try to figure out a way to build a little parachute so the egg can float to the ground. But you need to understand what the parameters are. What's going on when you drop an egg, and what's the problem? What's the issue? It's kind of obvious in a way, but then, eggs are fragile. They break. But the idea of coming to a different solution depends on understanding what the basic structure is. And what we would like to do is, find a different way of knowing, a different way of being in time and space. You could say that's the goal. I'm always a little nervous about goal-oriented language, but it depends on really understanding well what the problems are and how the problems arise, in our ordinary way of seeing. So the way Rinpoche puts this in this chapter, the first of the two chapters that we're reading for today, is that there's always a key to knowledge. In fact, there are many kinds of keys. You know, there are many possibilities, which is what he says on 298. You know, he says, there seem to be many keys. Why do we choose one key over another? How and why were the keys to the door of knowledge manufactured? But he asks that question in the context of saying, well, there is a key to our ordinary way of knowing, and that key is that it's self-centered. And so, again, that's the heading of the section within KTS here. The key to knowledge is that knowledge is what the knower knows. And I've said before at various times in this program that to me that's one of the most fundamental ways you can talk about what the vision of TSK is, especially if you're coming at it from a knowledge perspective. And that is, knowledge is not what the knower knows. Knowledge is not what the knower knows. Now, if you said that to somebody that you met on the street, I don't think they'd understand the significance of it very well. But when you've done the kind of analysis that we've been doing, then you begin to see why this is so fundamental. In the context of this chapter, in this reading, it should be very clear because, as Rinpoche says, the key to our ordinary knowing and the key to our way of being in time and space is that knowledge is what the knower knows. So there's a knower knowing. If you want to know, what's the key? That's it. And we want to explore how that works. Hayward says here that instead of saying the goal of TSK, you could say the benefit of TSK. I think that's true. So having a goal is very much a self-centered way of knowing, and that's why it's a little problematic. On the other hand, we do operate from that self-centered perspective. So it's not so terrible from my point of view to talk about goals, but you need to understand that when you're doing that, that makes sense within a story that the self tells. It's not really, you're not being true to the possibility that TSK holds out of not putting the self at the center, of finding other keys to knowledge. So, yeah, the benefit of TSK, I think that's good. Although if you pursue benefit, it kind of leads you in the same direction. We just, a benefit for whom or a benefit for what? It's just built in to everything about us. You know, this is the world we occupy. This is the key to the world that we occupy. So, it's okay. we just accept that and then see what we can do with it. So, Rinpoche spends a little bit of time talking about that in this chapter. He talks about how the self, let's take a look at actually just right below the paragraph I already mentioned on page 298, so it's the second paragraph on the page. He says, conventional knowledge is primarily the self's device for learning what is happening in its world, and as such belongs to the self. Only by means of the self's knowledge can we take part in the questioning, interpretation, creation, projection, and action. One could spend some time looking at that set of terms, but we won't. Only by means of the self-knowledge can we take part in all of these ways through which we learn the qualities and distinctions that make up our known world. So here's the self, here's its world. The self has ways of knowing which make available to it an understanding or appreciation of certain qualities of distinction and distinctions that are in fact the qualities and distinctions that give you the world of the self. And we've looked at this in various ways. The self and its world arise together. When Rinpoche looks at that, he's going to look at the structure. He says, what's the model? And he starts to go into that really in the next paragraph, so I'm just following along. He says, okay, so this is conventional knowledge, and there are certain rules that govern that knowledge. Right? And what's fundamental, the most fundamental thing, is that those rules are the most fundamental structure that bring those rules into operation is the subject-object structure. The knowing faculty is separate from what is to be known, and there are only certain ways for the knower to know the known. There's the sense operations, and there's certain kinds of mental operations. And even more fundamental than that, there's the fact that it's a process. Knowing is a process. And again, what that means is that because we can only know as the result of a process, until that process is underway, or even maybe until it's been completed, we're in a state of not knowing. So, you know, this seems hardly worth mentioning if you open your eyes and you see a clock in front of you, there's a process of knowing, but it's so quick, you know, that it seems unimportant to point toward the process. But the structure is really fundamental because the structure is a knower knowing a world in a process. And, of course, that process takes time. And so, you know, there's a moment of not knowing, and then there's a moment in which there's a process going on, and then there's a moment in which that process is completed, and now we can say, oh, now I know something. So that is the underlying temporal order that's in effect. Right? So if we just keep going with this section, on the top of page 299, Rinpoche writes that the self has to manufacture knowledge, that's the process, from the raw material of not knowing. So we look to sequences and consequences. We look to sequences and consequences. So notice that, again, the time factor is being brought in here. In order to make sense out of things, we try to understand how they have unfolded, the sequence of their unfolding, and the consequence. This happened, and then this happened. And so there's a whole linear temporal structure or temporal order that's in effect. And he uses an example here. Let's see, is John here? Yeah, John's the tracker, right? Does tracking. He uses the example of tracking here. He says, it's as though we were tracking an animal's footprints to understand something about the animal, right? But we never even ask what kind of animal made the footprints, which is not what trackers do. We get caught up in the sequence, we get caught up in the in looking at the consequences of what happens, or the process through which things happen, and we fail to really ask questions about the happening itself, you might say. So it's a little bit. I don't think I've talked in here about the image of Plato's cave. Famous, very famous image in Western philosophy, and I won't go into it all, but the basic idea is he says that it's as though all we ever see are images that are projected onto a cave, and it never even occurs to us that there's something that's projecting the images. This is kind of a similar notion, and it's based on the idea that we're focusing on this temporal sequence in which one thing brings about the next, the cause and effect structure, the structure of, you know, going from let's say, a moment in time, the past, to another moment in time, the present, which then gives way to the future, and the present becomes the past. All of that is implicit in this. And all of that is implicit in the story of the self. And he uses the term here, that this is a bystander way of being. The next chapter, or the reading for next week, talks more about the bystander. But basically, we're talking, you know, it's not wrong to say that we're talking about the self's way of being. So he also points out that you know, what we're missing is the broader view. He says, you know, we look to feedback, so we get, you know, we investigate what's going on, and we get feedback, and from that we project further understanding or you know, expand our sense of what's happening. But we don't ever look to the field within which feedback arises. We look at the bystander, but we don't ask how is it that the bystander mode of being comes into being? What's the basis for that? We accept the world of the self. This is the point, really, that Rinpoche is making. And we leave out of account whatever doesn't fit that model. We end up with this story of the self, and we've talked about that in the past, the founding story, which basically is, you know, the story that says, here I am. That's what we're stuck with. And there's a temporality involved with that. And here the theme of time is made explicit, still just reading along. At the last paragraph on 299, he says, with such a style of knowing in operation, whatever responds to a rhythm or sequence of time that does not allow for the operation of the self, I'll skip the rest, will remain unknowable. You know, we're stuck with bystander knowledge. We're stuck with a particular temporal order, which is arises in terms of cause and effect and so on. So that's the basic analysis that Rinpoche does. Now, that analysis goes on through the rest of the chapter, and I'm not going to follow it on out, I guess for the reason I said before, is because too long didn't read. People, we say, okay, I kind of get the idea. Now, it's really important, I think, to work it out, but we're just not going to do it right now. There's two things to say about it before we leave this particular theme. One is that it's so difficult to question because it operates on this fundamental level of time and space. And Rinpoche does specifically talk about that in the first paragraph on page 301. He says, these limits on knowledge are so thoroughly ingrained that they do not appear as limits at all. So you'd say this is what I've sometimes called before the natural attitude. Right? We just accept the way the world is. Well, of course this is the way the world is. And we do that, as he says here, because the limits that we operate with are given by space and time. We're born into a world, and this is our space, this is our time, this is our reality. But it never occurs to us to raise the possibility that space and time themselves could operate differently, or maybe a better way to say that a different vision of space and time could activate a different understanding of knowledge. And that, of course, is what we are working with. So the specifics that he goes into here are all really important. But, you know, so everything in the TSK books, in a certain sense, is important because it all leads to insight. It all leads to a questioning of our ordinary understanding. So, you know, we can't talk about everything. The So I'm going to skip ahead a little now and go to what I think is another consequence of this whole approach. And that is actually, it's in the next chapter. It's on page 304. Two things really. And these are just little summary points really. On 304 and at the end of the first full paragraph, he says, we don't ever ask about the self. We've set up a world in which the self is the knower, or the bystander is the knower, and we don't ask, as it said earlier, about the bystander way of being. And he says this makes everything very problematic. You know, we're building our whole understanding on the basis of this structure, and we don't ever question it because it doesn't occur to us to question it, and we don't know how. We don't know how we would do that question. So at the end of that paragraph, he says, beneath the level of personality and personal history and self-image, the unique nature of the being at the center of experience, the subject in a world of objects, remains strangely inaccessible. So this is very fundamental in the TSK vision and in our approach. You know, we want to question this model of the self at the center and the world that it inhabits, or the knower at the center and the known that is available. All of those structures, or the bystander in its world, or the bystander and outside standers. There's many, many ways that Rinpoche talks about this. And they all have a little bit different flavor, but they're all pointing in the same direction. There's this fundamental structure that puts the self at the center. And if you ask, what is the self? Or that's a little bit, that's not quite the right way to ask the question, really, although it's pretty good and helpful. But if you ask the question, is there a different way of being, or a different way of knowing, or a different, there are different possibilities for time and space? Well, we don't know. The questions are just inaccessible to us for the reasons we just talked about. Number one, they never occur to us. And number two, if they did occur to us, we just draw a blank when we say, well, how could we possibly look into that? We don't know. We have no idea. So this idea of strangely inaccessible is, I just wanted to underline that. And then the other point is on 305 in the last paragraph at the end, which again is the same point, but just driving it home. Here he's been talking about certain philosophical moves, that is, moves that get made in Western philosophy to try to understand what the self is. What's the relationship between the self and its world, or what's the relationship between mind and body, or what's the relationship between subject and object? These are all very problematic. So you could say philosophers are people who at least wake up to the fact that all this is problematic. Now, they maybe don't investigate it at the level of immediate personal significance, or you might say at the level of vision. But they at least investigated intellectually. And he's made the point here that this investigation has been going on for 2,500 years in the West, and the questions haven't really been resolved. There's all sorts of theories, but they haven't really been resolved. And he says at the bottom here of 305, he says, we might take this as an indication that there's something wrong with the basic formulations. So this is very nicely and politely put. You know, it's saying, well, you've had 25 years of thinking all this through and you still don't have an answer. Maybe you're not asking the right question, you know? Or maybe you're not asking it in the right way. This is really and implicit in that then is an invitation. And that invitation, the invitation is, well, let's ask differently. Right? So he says, our basic view of self and world, subject and object, may be fundamentally mistaken. That's where this analysis, I think, is meant to take us. And so, you know, as I said, people kind of want to say, yeah, okay, right, I understand. Now what do we do about it? So I think it is important to be a little more focused on the analysis and to see why it's wrong. One way of thinking about that is you could say we need to understand what are the good questions to ask, what are the right questions to ask. So if you look back at 304, at the section I was reading, he says, you know, there's a level of personality and personal history and self-image, and those are all interesting questions or interesting levels to explore, and they get explored in various disciplines and traditions. But if you've done this analysis, then you prepared yourself to say, yes, those are important, but we're talking about something still more fundamental. You have to really get a sense of how fundamental the questions that you're asking are. Okay, so having emphasized that, now I'm ready to start looking at the question of, so what could we do about it? What could we do differently? And starting with the clues that we already have, Rinpoche has been talking about how we're committed to a particular temporal order, right, in which events unfold. So the past, present, future structure. It's not the only thing he says here, but it's a very fundamental element, and it's the one that I want to focus on because we are looking at time. So the question to ask is there an alternative to the linear temporal structure? In other words, when I say linear temporal structure, I suppose it's obvious at this point, but what I'm really talking about is the way that time unfolds in our experience from past to present to future. And as soon as we ask that question, and it's been implicit in a lot of the things we've been looking at, this notion of sequences, of processes, of moving from not knowing to knowing, all of that really presupposes the linear temporal structure, past, present, and future. So asking that question is really the same, I think, as asking the question, how committed are we, or how much do we have to depend on the notion of a story, or you might say the founding story, which we've talked about. And I talked about a little earlier today, the notion of a story has built into it a past, present, future structure. It has a narrative, this happened, then this happened. And that is the world that we live in. And that's what Rinpoche means when he talks about a temporal order. There's a particular temporal order, and it's a story-like temporal order. So I'd actually like to have a stop for a moment. I have two practices in mind to start to investigate this question. I'm not sure we're going to get to the second practice. But the first one is a very simple practice, which we can do just for a minute. And that is to ask yourself, is it true that there's always a story operating in our experience? We've looked at this, but we want to take a minute to look at it right now. So when you look, it may not be a whole complicated story, but just as you let experience arise, and let's do this for a minute, is it in fact true to say that there's always a story involved? Or do you say, well, wait, that's not right. That's not my experience. Let's just look for a minute, and then I'll give you a chance to comment on that. Okay. So is it true? And if you say yes, how do you know? What did you find in your experience? And if you say no, how do you know? And what did you find in your experience? So I'm going to give people a chance to comment on that. I guess while we're waiting, I'll say something about it. It seems to me that sometimes we have experiences that are not based on a story. And the example I have in mind is sometimes in meditation, but you may also notice it in sometimes when you're lying down to go to sleep. There's just series of images that come, sort of strange, sometimes very beautiful images, that are not necessarily stories. It just seems like, you know, almost like in a kaleidoscope. I don't mean that kind of image, but there's just images, and one replaces the next. And so there may be instances like that, which are not story-centered. But I think those are the exceptions, and it would be interesting to say why those are the exceptions. But what else? Anybody else have anything to say about this? So John is saying, now somebody's typing in a kind of a noisy way. I guess it's okay, they'll live with it. John says, it seems like stories come often after a segment of experience. There's an observer self that comments on experience, often telling a story. Okay, I think that's a really good point. And it's one of the reasons why I asked the question, if you say yes, what's the basis for your saying yes? I think it's often the case that the way we make sense of our experience is by looking back at it. So you say, oh yeah, there was a story in that little sequence, you know, but you notice that afterwards, while it's happening, you could say, well, you're caught up in the story. And that's an important, very important structure, this sort of being caught up in is something that really helps explain, I think, a lot about our ordinary understanding of time. You might ask then, well, is the story something I impose on the experience afterwards? And while experience is happening, there's no story. I'm just going to leave that as a question for you. David says, I notice the stories I wrap myself in. I notice the images that the emotional stories are implicit. Maybe that means I notice the images. I'm not quite sure what you're saying there. Okay, but I also notice a dawning of insight at times that just appears or dawns. So there's a kind of a knowing or insight, is the word you've used, David, that maybe is not related to stories. I don't know that it's related to the images that I talked about earlier. So I think that's worth looking at and pointing out. My judgment on it doesn't matter so much. You're saying, sometimes there are stories, sometimes there's insight, which doesn't seem to have anything to do with stories. Or you might say, in fact, there's always insight, or at least there's some kind of an awareness, or there wouldn't be a story. The story is kind of added on to the insight, right? It's like another layer. What makes it possible to tell a story or to structure experience in terms of a story? Is it some capacity for insight? Maybe so. Okay. Ken says, I certainly found myself referring to the past followed by considering what my role would be in shaping that past's consequences for the future. Yeah, what you've described there is a really fundamental story structure, right? When you let the mind go, when you don't try to do anything in particular mentally, it seems as though what very quickly comes up in a lot of cases is the future, is the past, or sometimes the future. And if you go back to the past, there's a certain concern or a certain appreciation or a certain emotional reaction, which is what David, I think, was pointing out also. You end up making sense of things in a way that just absolutely depends on a story structure. You start working out a future that that's going to lead to. And let me say one thing that I've said before, but I think it's really important for this kind of question, and that is I don't think stories have to be all neatly tied up, you know, the way they would be if you read a story in a book. I think a lot of stories are just stories that you refer to. You know, you say it's like you've had this same thought or you've had this same concern again and again and again. So you just are kind of referring to the story. It comes up and you don't need to tell it to yourself in any detail. You already know the story. So and that is another element in the storytelling structure. Okay. John says, the entirety of the past is a story, one that keeps feeding the present if we continue to relive the story in our mind. Yeah, so the whole notion that the past is, what else could the past be, you know, if we're not in immediate contact with it? Isn't it in some sense a story? Well, we want to look at that, but that's it's a reasonable possibility at least to consider. And David says, and I think he's pointing to something I said once, like the image of a father, there's an implicit story within it. Yeah, I think I wrote that in the orientation. It's like, yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing I have in mind. A thought comes to mind, it's an image of someone you know, and there's a story that's built into that, your whole relationship with that person. Michael commenting on this says, a felt sense of limitation, of unrealized hopes, is a storyline for me this morning. This story doesn't help in any way, but it also shuts out my ability to access a wider perspective. The alternatives seem to be depression or indifference. Where can I find the open realm that sometimes comes unbidden? Well, I'm going to leave that question open for a moment because I think I want to say something about it at the end of our session today and then try to build on it in the orientation. Karen says, maybe there are images or thoughts whose stories we do not integrate or understand. Yes, that seems to me very likely and reasonable, right? There's an image that comes and it just seems strange. you don't know what to make of it. You know, sometimes you say, I had this weird image come into my mind and it doesn't seem to be related to anything. It's a little bit like in a dream, you know. You say, well, that was a strange dream. You don't know what it has to do with anything. But it could just be an image. It doesn't have to be a whole dream because dreams have their own plots. I mean, dreams usually are stories, right? So we don't know what to do with that. We don't know what to do with the image. But that doesn't mean there isn't a story underlying it. Maybe you could say the story is just so distant from our usual story that we don't know how to, as you say, Karen, don't know how to integrate. And Philip says, if my mind is in the present, then there seems to be no room for stories. So all the stories are from the past or imagining the future? Well, that's a very good, interesting question. So I'm going to take that question and Michael's comment or observation and try to say something about them to end up our session today. Let's see. So one thing you could say is, since stories do seem to always be related to the past and the future, wouldn't it be helpful if our goal is to explore the usual temporal order and look at the story structure, wouldn't it be helpful to be able to just stay focused in the present, where so that stories don't arise? It's just a kind of moment-to-moment arising. And that is a way to practice, it seems to me. That is a way, and by practice here, I mean a way to explore this. You know, you're saying, well, let's practice doing it differently. I don't mean like a formal practice. I mean, we say, let's see what happens if we just try to stay in the present, or if we just do stay in the present. It turns out it's not so easy to do. But let's say you could make that your practice. And there are certain practices in TSK. Going without going has some of that flavor to it. Marriage of Sound and Breath, those are some of the favorites, you know, in TSK for people who've done TSK for a while. And I think one of the reasons that they are favorite practices is because they seem to open up the possibility that you could let go of your connection to the past and the future and just dwell in the present. And then you would be challenging the usual temporal order, the story-centered order. That's one possibility. The other possibility, which I'm going to try to connect back into the question you asked, Michael, because it was clearly a meaningful question for you in this moment, and that is stories have a kind of an all-encompassing quality. So, you know, when you tell a story, you are, let's imagine first that you're just telling a story to someone else. What you do is you summarize the plot, right? This happened and then this happened. And what you're leaving out, if it's a story about something that happened to you, or maybe even a story about, you know, the story of a novel or of a film, what you're leaving out is the richer expanse of the story, the field, which, you know, we talked about that in terms of space, and Rinpoche in this chapter mentions too, that we leave out the field. So if you focus on just the plot, on the one event after another, you leave out this broader dimension. And so if we go back up to Michael's comment, he's pointing to that broader dimension when he says, find it again. Because of the story, he's not able to access a wider dimension. But what he actually says is there's a felt sense of limitation, of unrealized hopes, and that's the storyline. Well, that felt sense is a part of the story. That's what you would leave out if you were just talking about the plot. But that sense of the whole, you know, the story has its whole. And that's why I like to say that, you know, we inhabit our stories. We don't just tell them to ourselves. We inhabit them. So you know, Michael's comment is about that felt sense of the, you know, here we are. This is what's going on for me. And whatever the particular events that unfold, there's this broader sense of limitation, he says, and unrealized hopes. And that has to do with the story. And I suppose the point I want to make before we stop is that Michael writes that, you know, he's because of that, he's not able to access a wider perspective. But you could also say that when you bring in the felt dimension of a story or the lived or inhabited quality of a story, that's a whole. That's a field. And if you could engage that without judgment, let's say, and without focusing on the content, but just on the field, that puts time in a very different perspective. You know, whatever else is going on in the story, there's this ongoing sense. And then the question becomes, well, yeah, but the ongoing sense that Michael's referring to is this kind of depressed sense of limitation and unrealized hopes. Now you ask yourself, what's the story dimension that supports that? Without trying to figure it out, without trying to answer that question, but simply being aware of the field and at the same time being aware of the past, present, and future structure of the story. And I think that's a little bit vague, what I've just said. In fact, I think it's for me, a little hard to formulate, but I do think that's where I'd like us to go. So I'm going to give a walkabout practice, but it'll be in the orientation, that is about that. And it basically is just about letting the past and present and future of each moment, of each story, be available. And you notice that that's very different from what came up when we were talking about Philip's example. Philip said, you know, be in the present without without making a connection to the past and the future. But this other alternative, which I think is really important in the TSK vision, is let the past and the present and the future be a part of the present. Let there be a whole. I think the moving toward wholeness is always important in TSK. So explore that a little further in the orientation. And next week we will go more in that direction. I'm not sure that we'll do it in terms of stories so much. We'll see. But in the next set of readings, including that reading from KTS that I mentioned at the beginning, there are some suggestions, I think, a kind of an evocation of another possibility. So we'll stop there for today. I kept you a little long. I apologize. See you next week. Okay. Bye-bye.